action from the Biden administration. Develop plans for ending fossil fuel finance across all institutions as soon as possible within the 90-day time frame. While the executive order does not specify a deadline for Treasury to develop a strategy on the use of voice and vote, or a deadline for the specified agencies to articulate a plan to promote ending international financing of fossil fuel-based energy, we ask the strategies and implementation plans regarding voice and vote and international diplomacy also be completed within a 90-day time frame, similar to what was specified for other areas such as the development of the climate finance plan. Clear Treasury guidance on the multilateral development banks should be released as soon as possible in order to establish the U.S. position ahead of the Asian Development Bank's forthcoming energy policy review, with a draft policy due to be released within weeks. Have all measures take effect soon after the completion of the plan, while also seeking comment on ways to strengthen the plans further, and to conduct a public consultation process aimed at ensuring the outcome is as ambitious as possible. By promoting fossil fuel projects overseas, especially gas infrastructure, the U.S. is making it harder for countries to decarbonize. Han Chen, Manager of Energy for International Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council, said in a statement. Han Chen added, "We have to stop subsidizing fossil fuel companies at the expense of our climate."
European News Bulletin.
Welcome to the Bulletin. My name is Amina Taylor, and we're broadcasting from the British capital. And it's here we begin our top story. Violent clashes between UK police and protesters over a proposed law making its way through the country's parliament. Now, if adopted, the so-called Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill will change the way protests are held in this country forever. And that has had campaigners and civil liberties groups up in arms as Saeed Poreza fills us in.
Bristol, southwest England on the weekend. A peaceful march against government-proposed legislation that gives the police sweeping powers descended into violence. Some clashed with the police, others vented their anger and frustration in other ways. As darkness set in, the situation escalated further. Fireworks were thrown, police vans set on fire, several officers injured.
I'm opposed to violence of all kinds. That, yes, if there are people who are protesting being violent, I think that they are doing the wrong thing, because you don't need to be violent in every situation.
Peaceful protest, very much in support of, not in support of violence. And I'd be very interested to see the discussion about professional agitators, whether that's true. It certainly looked like it on TV.
But that doesn't take away from the seriousness of the government's Police, Crime, Sentencing and Courts Bill. And here is why it matters. Scenes on March 13th of women being manhandled by police officers while attending a peaceful vigil in memory of a young woman murdered allegedly by a police officer.
I think it's fundamentally wrong to stop people's right from protest, right from speaking out, because what other power do we have as a people? You know, that is our biggest power. And if you think of history, all the movements have happened, all the powerful change that was created through protest, through crowds, through gathering.
I get the intention, but I think it just gives the police too many powers, and I think their timing is also pretty poor, given how the police are being viewed at the moment. They're losing an awful lot of support.
Having seen the way police broke up the vigil for Sarah Everard, whose murder acted as a poignant reminder about increasing male violence against women, Campaigners are concerned about more powers for law enforcement, although the government took issue with the police treatment of the peaceful demonstrators.
Mr. Speaker, let me turn to this weekend's events. I've already said that some of the footage circulating online of Clapham Common is upsetting. So whilst the police are rightly operationally independent, I asked the Metropolitan Police for a report into what had happened.
Opposition parties and campaigners say the bill is deeply imbalanced, that it imposes gratuitous curbs on peaceful protests and does too little to protect women, that it introduces longer jail terms for vandalism or defacing statues and memorials than it does for rape.
The UK's Conservative government says the wide range of steps it's taking is necessary to keep people safe. Its new policing bill has already cleared the first parliamentary hurdle, and given the government's large parliamentary majority, it's almost guaranteed to become law, despite some libertarian concerns among its own MPs. Saeed Riza, London.
Well, author and political commentator John Wright joins us from Edinburgh. John, you've written about this very bill. May I ask you to quickly recap your thoughts?
Well, this bill is a panicked reaction by the establishment to the wave of protests that took place last year across England and Wales, starting with the toppling of the statue of Colston, attacking other monuments, statues of people associated historically with the British slave trade, and most prominently the defacing of Churchill's statue in Parliament Square in London. Because this establishment knows that after statues come tumbling down, often the walls of false consciousness follow. And so this is a rising wave of consciousness regarding Britain's role in the world, past and present, and the Tory establishment is desperate to try and stem this rising tide of resistance and contesting of the official narrative of British history.
Is that how you would categorise what we saw in Bristol over the weekend?
Yes, I do. Karl Marx, it was who said, Amina, that necessity without consciousness is blind, and freedom is the consciousness of necessity. And those scenes, as ugly as they were, reflect the ugliness of the legislation involved, which arrogate to the police frightening new powers that would not look out of place in a totalitarian state. And, you know, it wasn't only the protesters who were violent. Some of the scenes, the pictures I've seen on social media, some of the footage shows that the police adopted a very heavy-handed approach, just as they did at the vigil to Sarah Everard, who was abducted and brutally murdered, allegedly by a serving police officer. So the optics could not be worse. People were sitting down in front of a police station quietly, peacefully, and then the police arrived on horseback and in riot gear. So there was provocation, I think. I think the police in England especially have never been in a worse state in terms of public confidence, and I think this reflects a rising tide of consciousness as to this mob, the real mob that we're dealing with and people have to be scared of, which is in government.
Now, you say all of this, John, but yet the Conservatives enjoy good polling results. This despite the way in which some have said they've handled the pandemic, this proposed bill. What are we saying now about the opposition, but also about where people's minds are at a time like this?
This government's enjoying strong polling in England, not in Scotland. Let's make that clear. It does speak to a very weak opposition. Keir Starmer is an establishment man. He is Tory light, in my view. He's done his best to defenestrate Labour of its socialist policies under the Corbyn leadership that preceded him. But I think it speaks most prominently to the establishment or the introduction of US-style culture wars into the UK's political spectrum, into his narrative, over race, over ethnicity, over religion. And Brexit, of course, has unleashed a carnival of reaction. And Boris Johnson enjoys strong support from people who think Brexit is everything and is an end in itself. And, of course, nothing he can do will hamper that support, just as Donald Trump has a strong base despite all his criminal negligence and incompetence and racism and so forth. So the UK has never been more polarised, consensus nowhere, chaos everywhere, and I think it speaks to Britain's international, political and social decline. It's been a long time coming. This is just a tipping point, and I think we're in for a long, hot summer of social unrest in the UK.
A long, hot summer, albeit of social unrest. Thank you so much, John White.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Now, Richard Sudan, we saw those scenes. We've heard what Saeed Poureza and John White had to say about their particular views on what took place over the weekend. Your stance?
So it's interesting, Amina, and social media is awash with debate and different reactions. And I want to take a look at this first headline, which says, "Police chief condemns the violence and destruction as 20 officers are injured." Now, the reason we've chosen this headline is because the media establishment, if you like, have largely ran with this narrative, talking about the destruction of police vans and, of course, the injuries to police officers. Now, the reaction is mixed on social media, but a lot of people are basically saying that the government is going to, of course, spin this in their favour to make the argument that the bill must, of course, be pushed through. And actually, what's interesting also is a lot of people, Amina, are frankly sceptical and are asking questions about the minority element of these protests, which actually caused the destruction. People are saying, look, we've seen in the past examples where demonstrations have been infiltrated with the sole intention of making the protest turn violent, precisely to spin in the government's favour. So you've seen one narrative, if you like, from the mainstream media, but actually many users on social media are very much aware of the potentiality for other narratives, if you like, to have taken place. And certainly that's what's being discussed online at the moment.
All right, let's hear what they had to say in their own words.
Let's go first to David Holt, who comes from the other side, if you like. David Holt says, "We are under attack from leftism. They cannot cope with their constant failures, so they turn to violence." McArdle says, "Presumably there are undercover police who've infiltrated anarchist and extremist groups who can now torch property to kick off a riot and not face prosecution. Just part of the job." And we have a reaction from Moomin, who says, "I've not seen any footage of the Bristol riots. I'm anti-violence and find that stuff depressing. That said, people are angry, angry with the police bill, angry with the regime corruption, and fuming at police assaulting innocent women last week. It's not right, but perhaps understandable." So this debate is really raging online at the moment, Amina.
Right, and we move across the Atlantic for the second wave of a very disturbing story. The murder a few days back of 8 people in a particular part of Atlanta. And just fill us in on what happened and why it's important. Why have you chosen this story?
Absolutely. So our headline talks about the Atlanta Spa shooting, and Robert Arrett Long, who this headline is now talking about, has been kicked out of a Georgia church. So what's interesting is there have been a number of things, really, which people are saying are humanizing this man. This headline talks about the fact he was a church goer. One of the police chiefs actually said that Robert Aaron Long had a bad day. There's other news pieces talking about him being a kind of nerdy, quiet, shy, geeky guy at school. But I think the point here for a lot of people is that, you know, for a long time over the last few weeks, we've seen the narrative that black people have been attacking Asian people in the Asian community. And here is an example of Robert Aaron Long, a conservative guy from a rural part of Georgia, massacring 8 people for which he's been charged. 6 of them are Asian Americans, and many people are saying this is the definition of a hate crime. Other people are saying this is an example of a domestic act of terrorism, and they are saying that the media is reluctant to really diagnose it thusly. And so there's a kind of difference, if you like, between what people are saying is the actual reality and the narrative again being pushed by sort of sections of the media. And people are saying, look, let's just call it what it is.
And indeed, if it was anyone else, and what's social media calling it, Richard Sudan?
Okay, let's go first to Philip Walker, who says, "You can look no further than the sudden false narrative that black people are targeting Asians. Meanwhile, white supremacist operatives like Robert Arrett Long are massacring Asians en masse. Bishop Talbot Swan says, while America tries to paint a black face on anti-Asian violence, a white supremacist, Robert Arrett Long, murders 8 Asians in Atlanta, and authorities won't call him a terrorist, they're mentioning sex addiction and saying they don't know the motive. And US Political Theatre says, did the police also take domestic terrorist Robert Arrett Long to Burger King for lunch, like they did with domestic terrorist neo-Nazi Dylan Roof after he murdered 9 black people in a church?
Well, leave it there, Richard Sedan. Thank you. Now, Palestine has begun administering the first doses of the COVID-19 vaccine it's received from the global COVAX initiative to healthcare workers and older residents in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. The United Nations-backed COVAX program delivered some 61,400 vaccines to the Palestinian Authority, with 21,300 jabs also being shipped to the besieged Gaza Strip. The news comes months after the Palestinian Authority blasted the Israeli regime for its decision to block vital vaccines from being delivered to the impoverished West Bank and Gaza Strip. Amnesty International and the World Health Organization have also joined in their calls to Israel, asking Tel Aviv to stop ignoring its international obligations as an occupying power and ensure the fair distribution of vaccines to Palestinians. 5 of Europe's southern states have stepped up calls for help and solidarity to other EU countries in managing the mass influx of refugees from entering the bloc. Interior ministers from Italy, Spain, Malta, Cyprus and Greece met over the weekend to discuss the issue and hash out a new migration pact, which would share the burden of mass migration with other members of the bloc. Thousands of refugees fleeing from Western-backed wars in places like Libya and Syria have died in the perilous maritime journey to reach EU shores. Critics of the EU have previously accused the 27-nation bloc of evading its responsibilities towards people making the journeys. More than half of all the UK adults have had their first COVID vaccination, with plans in place to immunise the entire adult population by the end of the summer. Efforts are now underway to open large public events with COVID passports as a possible solution. But as Murtaza Jaffa reports, there is a growing backlash against such proposals.
As the UK races ahead with its vaccine rollout, discussions have turned to normalising large public gatherings such as sports events, cinemas and theatre shows. Britain's Culture Secretary, Oliver Dowden, has revealed that the government are now considering COVID passports to allow people to attend large-scale public events from June the 21st.
We'll be testing whether we can use COVID certification to help facilitate the return of sports. Obviously, final decisions have not been taken on that, and I'm working with the Chancellor of Duchy of Lancaster, Michael Gove, who is leading on our COVID certification work programme. But I think that is a potential tool that could help the return of the things that we love.
Campaigners have been quick to push back against such proposals, adamant such a move would restrict people's right to refuse any form of vaccination. More than 300,000 people have signed a petition against COVID passports, citing MP Nadeem Zahawi, the secretary in charge of the vaccine rollout, who said there were no plans for vaccine passports back in December 2020. Last week's unease over potential blood clots being linked to the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine added more anxiety. In Brussels, the EU have announced similar proposals to facilitate freedom of movement within the bloc. Their digital green certificate would allow their 450 million residents to travel freely between nation states, one of the essential 4 freedoms that make up the European Union. This has become critical as a third wave of infections continues to spread. The digital green certificates will apply to tourists also. British holidaymakers who've been quick to book their European getaways are finding themselves having to get vaccines and COVID passports before travelling. Turkey, however, have come out and declared they will not be imposing such criteria, a marketing ploy designed to attract vaccine-weary holidaymakers. Concerns over vaccines and human rights will remain ongoing. Anti-vax campaigners will continue their crusade, but those in the entertainment industry, as well as countries reliant on tourism, will be desperate to get their economies back up and running. In this vein, many feel vaccine passports will ultimately become part of the new normal.
Earlier today, ministers from the European Union met in Brussels to discuss the bloc's relations with Turkey and Russia. High on the agenda will be the ongoing dispute over hydrocarbon resources in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea between Turkey, Cyprus, and Greece. Other points of discussion will include the Turkish detention of Kurdish politicians, as well as the imprisonment of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny. The meeting comes weeks after the 27-nation bloc announced it would be slapping retaliatory sanctions on Moscow over the Navalny case. Following their statement, Russia accused the bloc of interfering in the country's internal affairs. Robert in Lakesh, welcome back to the Bulletin. We're going to kick things off with, dare I say, some more misinformation being directed about Iran from Washington. Take it away.
Well, this time we see the report coming from The Hill. A number of different United States outlets, of course, take the words of U.S. Intelligence officers, as they call them, verbatim, no matter what they're saying. We're seeing this again in the case of this report, where they're saying that Iran had discussed a plan to attack a U.S. Army base in Washington, D.C. They cite two unnamed officials, and it's key that they are unnamed. There was no comment when they tried to reach out to the Pentagon and to intelligence agencies to verify these claims. But many people are pointing out that this comes at a crucial time when the Biden administration is attempting to get itself away from the responsibility which it pledged itself to, that is, getting back into the JCPOA or Iran nuclear deal. And on top of that as well, it looks like the Biden administration is poised to launch more strikes against the PMU, perhaps in Syria or in Iraq, again, as it did last month after an attack which targeted U.S. forces not linked to Iran. But of course, the U.S. media helped manufacture that dissent when it came to the retaliation, as it was called, which came to a group which was completely irrelevant to the strikes in the country.
So the easiest way now to justify your foreign policy is to just say Iran, whatever.
Absolutely. And we're seeing that reports like this are surfacing all the time when the Biden administration has pressure applied to it to try and get something achieved. And in this case, a promise which the Biden administration pledged, and that was to attempt to get back into the Iran nuclear deal, which they have not done. This is a foreign policy layup, as it has been called and described by many analysts. And we're seeing that Joe Biden has completely ignored this.
All right. What's been the online reaction to this story, Robert?
The first we've got here is from Hamid Marandi, who says, "The obedient American media mimics whatever garbage intelligence agencies tell them. They did that before the aggression against Iraq. They did that before bombing and destroying Libya. They did that regularly in Syria to justify aiding Al-Qaeda and illegal military strikes. Never ending," he says. And we've got another one here from journalist Max Blumenthal, who says, "The national security state is fabricating threats to overpower local opposition to further militarization of D.C. First, the bogus threat of QAnon attacks, then this month to justify extending the National Guard occupation of Capitol Hill, and now this."
Okay, we move on to, well, some would say an inevitability in Israeli politics. New elections in just, what, 2 days?
Yes, we will see the elections on this Tuesday coming. And a lot of people, of course, in disarray, as things can only get worse from here for Palestinians. It seems that Netanyahu has successfully divided up his opposition. Former opposition member Benny Gantz of the Blue and White Party essentially has been destroyed in the polls. We're seeing that he will not even, or his party will barely make it into the Israeli Knesset this time around. And last time, Netanyahu had 4 opposition parties against him. Now he has 10. So his bid to divide has been successful. And on top of that, he's aligning himself with right-wing racist groups, the likes of which are Otzma Yehudit, or Jewish Power, as it's known in English, which essentially has been compared to the KKK because of its hardline racist views. Its leader, in fact, was convicted in 2007 of supporting a terrorist organization and inciting racism. And so when we talk about the Palestinians in this instance, we're seeing that if Netanyahu gets in, he's aligned with these far-right racist parties. And then if his opposition win as well, the number one figure against him is a man named Gideon Saar. Also, things are not looking good for the Palestinians because Gideon Saar is even more hardline than Netanyahu when it comes to the Palestinian issue and calls for the expulsion of Palestinians.
Tweets?
The first we've got here is from an Israeli actually commenting on this. They say 55,000 people last night all yelling go, leave us alone to start rebuilding our lives and our country, a demonstration of power, protest, and a call for change to remove corrupted Netanyahu and his messengers from power, elections in 2 days. So an unhappy Israeli there. Then we have another one here as well commenting on the issue of Netanyahu's being aligned to these racist parties. Says Netanyahu allies with extremist party denounced by many American groups, APACs actually included in that, who are openly calling for the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians.
And this is a man who's facing charges. I don't understand why he's even allowed to run briefly, Robert.
Well, this victory will mean that he can attempt to get past a bill which would essentially mean that the charges being brought against him would be dropped. So for him, this is a crucial victory to win, and that's why we're seeing him align so he can get those 61 seats in the Knesset and win.
Well, anything to save your skin, some might say. Robert Inlakesh, thank you, and thank you for being with us for this broadcast. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
As a reminder, we said that Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, highly respected the source of emulation, Grand Ayatollah Hussein Burujerdi. Although the Imam himself was an outstanding figure among the religious scholars or ulama of seminaries, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, played an important role in bringing Grand Ayatollah Burujerdi from Burujerd to Qom, and strengthening his status as the greatest source of emulation of his era. Today, we are going to talk about Imam Khomeini's political approach during the era of Grand Ayatollah Bulujadi. Stay with us. Shia Muslims believe that government is only the right of the infallible imams, peace be upon them, or person who enjoys the most resemblance to the infallible imam. Some Shia religious scholars or ulama maintain that if it is impossible to establish an Islamic government, the Islamic community should cooperate with just rulers in a bid to prevent the shedding of innocent blood and setting the ground for implementation of justice in society. However, there are other religious scholars or ulama who reject direct cooperation with rulers and believe that Shia ulama must always keep an eye on the performance of rulers in order not to be tainted with politics. Hence, there are various approaches among religious scholars or ulama with respect to the relation of religion and politics. Grand Ayatollah Bulujadi rejected direct cooperation with the ruling system and stressed that ulama should supervise the activities of the rulers. But Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, not only rejected any cooperation with the ruling system, but also deemed the system as illegitimate and deemed it necessary to set up an Islamic system of government known as Walayat-e-Faqih, or rule of the supreme jurisprudent. Imam Khomeini, even before the arrival of Grand Ayatollah Bulujadi in Qom, had written the book Kashful Asrar, in defense of over a millennium of struggles of Shia religious scholars or ulama in the field of safeguarding genuine Islam and deterring deviationist currents. He proved his high capacity in scrutinizing and analyzing various political currents and proving the pristine Islamic teachings. Imam Khomeini stepped up his political struggles after the passing away of Grand Ayatollah Bulujadi. These struggles shaped nationwide demonstrations and finally led to the overthrow of the corrupt and despotic Pahlavi regime. During the leadership of Grand Ayatollah Bulujadi, Imam Khomeini refrained from causing rifts in the ranks of ulama and Muslims and tried his best to keep the respect and status of Grand Ayatollah Bulujadi. Thus, he would just give the Grand Ayatollah political consultation if there was a need to do so. Ayatollah Sobhani recounts the anecdote. He says, "During the era of Grand Ayatollah Bulujadi, we witnessed a glorious silence from Imam Khomeini. From the arrival of Grand Ayatollah Bulujadi in Qom till his passing away, the Imam only engaged in teaching, writing books and training students. What caused the Imam's roaring cries to subside after the arrival of Grand Ayatollah Bulujadi in Qom? The point is that the Imam was the man of God. His move and silence was based on the axis of duty." Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, attached very high importance to the position of source of emulation, especially the top one, who was at the helm of the seminaries. The most important thing for Imam Khomeini was unity and solidarity of different Islamic currents and sects. Once, one of the ulama or religious scholars in Qom had been beaten by the police in the city. Imam Khomeini was informed of this event, but he didn't make any decision, saying that it is the responsibility of the source of emulation and the head of the seminaries. He recommended the students to refer to Grand Ayatollah Bulujadi and didn't interfere in his responsibilities. Later, Ayatollah Muhammad Yazdi recalls that in 1955, the famous preacher Mr. Falsafi started his struggles against Baha'ism in support of Grand Ayatollah Burujadi, whilst the Pahlavi regime pretended to back the move. But we were faced with the Shah's 180-degree U-turn. He humiliated the source of emulation and the great religious scholars or ulama of Tehran. The Imam told me and a few people who had gone to him to know our duty on the event. If Grand Ayatollah Burujadi permits, I will arouse the whole of Iran in one day against the Shah. In reaction to some of the friends to enter the scene of parliamentary election through nomination of some pious candidates, Imam Khomeini didn't accept the proposal for the respect of Grand Ayatollah Burujadi and said that he would continue teaching and his other activities in seminary. Ayatollah Subhani recalls that he says, "I remember in 1951 when the parliamentary election was heated and the constituencies had been divided between the advocates of Mossadegh and the Shah, while none of the candidates was accepted by the ulama. One of the friends, by the name of Sheikh Asadullah Nurullahi, asked the Imam to enter the scene and introduce pious and committed candidates, or at least introduce one candidate for the city of Qom. But he apologized and reminded, he said, my duty is just teaching."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 22, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the eighth session of the Assembly.
For example, the Islamic government is faced with conditional pressures imposed by the enemy. In such situations, we notice that the cure for this is to act on this ayah. Therefore, stand firm on the straight path as you are commanded, you and those who with you turn unto Allah. This is a public matter, not a personal matter. In the Holy Quran, the terms patience and stand firm sometimes refer to the Holy Prophet himself, not people. For example, the ayah, but for your Lord's cause, be patient and constant. Chapter 74, verse 7 is addressed to the Holy Prophet, but in this case, it concerns people as well. Therefore, stand firm in the straight path as you are commanded, you and those who with you turn unto Allah.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Everyone should stand firm and resist. In other words, it asks us to make a public move, showing patience and standing firm. Therefore, We understand from this ayah that in such circumstances, we should act like this. Therefore, stand firm in the straight path, or accept such as have faith and show patience and constancy. We should show patience and encourage one another to stand firm, to resist, and to have patience and constancy.
این خب وقتی یه چنین چیزی پیش میاد برای ما اون مفهوم فستقم کما امرت و من تاب معک کاملا روشن میشه. قبل از این خیلی مفهوم روشنی برای ما نداره.
So, when such an issue arises, the concept of therefore stand firm in the straight path as you are commanded, you and those who with you turn unto Allah, becomes completely clear to us. Before the emergence of such issues, it is not completely clear to us.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Nowruz Special. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Nowruz is an ancient Iranian feast which has remained fresh for several millennia. If you remember, we briefly discussed myths and their relation with Nowruz. In continuation of the discussion, we are going to dwell upon the myths of the Sasani era and the Islamic era
and we'll talk about the ways of holding Nowruz feasts in those eras. Stay tuned, please. The Sasanid kings ruled in Iran from 224 to 651 AD and were considered among the important empires in old times. In those days, Iran's official religion was Zoroastrianism, although Christian and Jewish minorities also lived in the country. Nowruz enjoyed a special position among the public and the authorities and used to be marked very gloriously. They used to celebrate Nowruz at least for 6 days. It contained the minor Nowruz and the major Nowruz. Before the start of the feast, there were other customs like house cleaning. And there was Sizdebedar custom, which was marked 1 week after the Nowruz days to end the spring celebrations. Iranians called the first 5 days of spring as the minor Nowruz. This period belonged to the public, and they could attend the presence of the kings. During these ceremonies, visitors would offer presents to the king, and after the 5 days, the major Nowruz started, which lasted only for 1 day. On this day, authorities like government officials would go to the palace, and then Nowruz celebrations would end. Nowruz in those days was so notable that it impacted even the music and poetry of the era. Thus, poets such as Manuchehri and Nezami composed poems on Nowruz. Traces of Nowruz can be found in the books of old writers too. They used to write much on decoration of homes and roofs and illuminating alleys and passages. Their accounts on the kinds of foods and drinks and the clothes of people too. After the Sasanid era, we reach the Islamic era. After the acceptance of Islam by the majority of Iranian people, Nowruz became a national feast with a religious tinge. The Umayyad and Abbasid caliphs at first paid little attention to Nowruz, but the peaceful nature of Nowruz and the way Iranians marked it made the rulers to accept it. The first independent dynasty which ruled Iran after the Sasanid kings was the Tahiri dynasty, which emerged in the great Khorasan. In their era, Nowruz was celebrated very gloriously, and according to Abu Rehan Biruni, the rulers of Khorasan in the 4th century AH used to give spring and summer garments to their troops in Nowruz. The Samanid and Ghaznavid rulers and rulers after them also marked Nowruz and other less important feasts. But after the Mongol onslaught, conditions totally changed in Iran. Nowruz, like many other traditions and customs, lost its significance and grandeur due to carnage and pillage that were rampant everywhere. However, Nowruz catapulted to fame once more so that during the Safavid era, it turned again into a national and religious feast. Ever since, Iranians have preserved Nowruz like a precious heritage. Presently, Nowruz is celebrated gloriously in Iran and many countries with similar traditions and customs. One of the common customs is the spreading of haftsin tablecloth. As it was said earlier in this series, haftsin tablecloth consists of 7 items beginning with the Farsi letter sin, the equivalent of S in English. Each of these items symbolizes a phenomenon. Samanu, that is, wheat sprout, pudding, is the symbol of bounty and plenitude. Somak, or sumac, is the symbol of sunrise. Sekke, or coin, is the symbol of wealth. Sieb, or apple, is the symbol of beauty and health. Serke, or vinegar, is the symbol of patience and life. And sir, or garlic, is the symbol of treatment or medicine. Dear listeners, if you remember, we mentioned sabze, or green sprouts, which symbolizes rebirth and revival, as another ingredient of this tablecloth, whereas senjet, that is oleaster fruit, is the inseparable part of this tablecloth, and it is the symbol of rationality and generation. One of the most important ingredients of pafts in tablecloth is a copy of the Noble Quran. Iranian Muslims start their new year in the name of God and remembrance of God. Iranian non-Muslims too put their holy book in the tablecloth as a source of blessing. Iranian Nowruz has survived the hard times during over 2,000 years. This great feast has united Iranians from all walks of life and every religion. The ninth day of this year's Nowruz has coincided with one of the greatest feasts of Muslims, namely the birth anniversary of the awaited savior of mankind, Imam Mahdi, peace upon him. May God help us be true followers to this Imam and prepare the ground for his reappearance. Amen.
Around the world with reporters.
The first summit between China and the United States since the election of Joe Biden produced an unexpected and extraordinary diplomatic blow-up. During opening remarks, top U.S. diplomats tried to present China as a global threat, airing a litany of complaints about the way China's government and political culture differs from the West. That breach of diplomatic norms led to an hour of public arguing, which saw China's top diplomat, Yang Jiechi, point out that the U.S. was, quote, massacring the people of other countries and, quote, toppling regimes through the use of force. Yang called the U.S. the champion of cyber attacks, noted that blacks in the U.S. are slaughtered, and asked the U.S. to, quote, stop advancing its own democracy in the rest of the world, a democracy which Yang said many Americans no longer have confidence in. The summit may come to be viewed as the beginning of a new geopolitical era defined by Chinese confidence.
A lot of the, you know, ruling class in the U.S. is very used to thinking of China as like this poor, dominated country that in recent decades has just been a source of cheap labor. And they're really frightened that this country that should have been, you know, dominated and defeated is, you know, standing up as a world power.
Just prior to the summit, Biden placed sanctions on 24 Chinese officials, which may have been designed to end any chances for cooperation even before the meeting began.
The Obama administration's pivot to Asia policy shifted the Pentagon's planning from the Muslim world to China. Biden has continued with an openly antagonistic approach, which rejects Beijing's call for cooperation amid the multiple global crises.
I just think there's so much opposition to cooperation and so much support for a new Cold War that even if Biden wanted to cooperate with China, he couldn't. Like, Trump wanted a peace deal with North Korea, a much less, like, strategic threat to the United States, and Trump wasn't able to get that through.
The talks concluded without the issuance of a final joint statement. Experts in both nations say few should expect a significant improvement in bilateral relations between the two superpowers. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
For decades now, people of Kashmir haven't witnessed any celebrations. The conflict in the region has always spoiled their joy and happiness. However, when it comes to Nowruz festival, which marks the beginning of spring, hope for a better tomorrow gives people of this war-weary region a chance to rejoice. Now people have gathered in the heart of Kashmir's capital city of Srinagar, where almond trees are blossoming to mark the arrival of spring.
People of Kashmir have nothing to rejoice, and we have faced turmoil for decades. But when we see the cycle of life in nature and how life is revived, I and many like me begin to revive too. We only hope to have a spring year round, since we have missed it for decades.
Youngsters are busy clicking on images and filling their social media timelines, while others are enjoying the beauty of fresh blooms. And to add to this glory, Kashmir's administration has organized a concert.
Spring will soon begin, and we wanted to start on a happy note. We want people of Kashmir to be full of hope, energy, and enthusiasm, so that this energy boosts their morale throughout the year.
Nowruz, a Persian tradition of welcoming spring, became part of the culture of Kashmir after Persian scholars and saints came to Kashmir and preached Islamic teachings centuries ago. Since then, Kashmir and Persia have shared many similarities, including food. Here at the Little Persia, friends and families have gathered in Kashmir's only Persian food-serving restaurant to celebrate the occasion of Nowruz. The owner says the practice aims to retain the fantastic culture of Persia through food.
I came back to Kashmir like 7 years before. I noticed I was always intrigued by the cultural similarities we have with the Persian community, or per se like the Iranian community, or with Iran. So I noticed those similarities, and I dwelled in the history and in the books of, like, you know, of a tradition. And then I got to know, like, you know, we were one of the tribes that actually came from there, and then we settled here. So our culture is, like, majorly influenced and pretty much originates from that part of the world.
Picturesque Kashmir, known as the Venice of East, attracts tourists from around the globe. However, decades of turmoil and now the COVID-19 pandemic have pushed the region's economy to its ever lowest. Nowruz symbolizes hope, revival, and life. People of Kashmir say no one other than those suffering in this world would realize the importance of a new beginning, and they only hope to see their spring season last long. Shahana Butt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
The 6th of Shaban is the title of the latest retaliatory attack carried out by the Yemeni army against one of Aramco oil sites in the Saudi capital Riyadh using drones. The Yemeni army says the operation comes in response to the Saudi continued deadly aggression.
The Yemeni army will continue its strategic operations deep inside Saudi Arabia until the sources of oil dry up. And Aramco, the source of Saudi economy, is destroyed. We will force the Saudi enemy to realize the reality of our capabilities. These operations will continue until the war is stopped and the blockade imposed on our country is lifted.
The Saudi regime confirmed the attack, saying it has caused a fire in the oil refinery in Riyadh and it was controlled. Observers say the Yemeni army should continue such attacks to deal heavier damage to the Saudi economy.
These operations will not have an impact unless the oil facilities are continuously attacked. The oil is the lifeline of the Saudi economy, and Saudi Arabia is using oil money to buy mercenaries and weapons. So these operations must not stop.
For 6 years now, Yemenis have been under a devastating war imposed by Saudi Arabia and its